from the Gable Media Podcast Network and presented by Lines. This is Spaces, the podcast where we make sense of the spaces that shape society. I'm your host, Demetrius Lynch. Hello! Thanks for coming back, everybody. And if you're new here, welcome. This is episode 209. What if the loneliness many people feel today is not just a social problem, but a design problem? Today's conversation is about community, connection, and how the built environment can either isolate us or bring us back together. I'm joined by Colby Cox, founder and CEO of Convergence Communities, a real estate development firm based in Jackson, Wyoming. Colby has spent more than 20 years developing mixed-use, master-planned communities focused on human connection, well-being, and what he describes as living intentionally. His work is shaped by a simple but powerful question: what kind of legacy does a place leave 50 or 100 years from now? And through projects like the Granary in Milton, Delaware, Colby is testing how porches, smaller lots, shared open spaces, programming, public amenities, and even a brewery incubator can help move people out of isolation and into relationship. In our conversation, Colby explains why the typical suburban model often works against community, why fear and liability can overpower good design, and why true return on investment has to include reputation, legacy, and quality of life. We discuss loneliness, zoning, pro formas, public space, community programming, and how development can become a tool for belonging. Enjoy.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
Colby, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Colby, I'm excited to get into this conversation. When your team reached out to me, it was a very eye-catching subject matter, talking about loneliness in regards to our built environment. And I'm just coming off of a limited series that I did where I touched on some of that a little bit. So I'm excited to see, to hear your perspective and kind of what you're trying to do from a developer sense to address that. But before we jump into that part of the conversation, tell me a little bit about yourself and the company, Convergence Communities, and anything else that listeners should know to kind of understand a little bit more about where you're coming from.
Yep. My name is Colby Cox. I own Convergence Communities. I started it when I was 22 years old and had worked for a large home builder for a very brief period of time, Centex Homes. They don't exist anymore, but I graduated from college with a degree in real estate finance and construction engineering and knew that I wanted to be in the world of developing places, but didn't really know how to get my start. So worked for a large home builder for about 6 months and then broke away from them, took one of their construction managers that had been there for, I think, 6 or 7 years with me, and a guy who had worked for Enron at the time, which was imploding. And we started a company. And basically, the idea was that we would start a construction company and develop some revenue building projects for other people, and then use some of that money to put option contracts on land and try to get into the land development game. And essentially, that worked. I ended up buying those guys out pretty early in the process, just different visions for the company. And then it became my company within 18 months after we started. And it's been that way ever since. So I've always been fascinated with the built environment, specifically community development, more than anything. And you know, the history of community, I would say, and anything from large scale urban environments. You know, I spent a lot of time traveling around the world, looking at different places and how they've, you know, how they were built thousands of years ago, all the way to more recently. And then I saw a lot of what was going on in, let's call it, modern projects around me. And I grew up in Delaware, the rural eastern shore of Delaware, and it was a beautiful place, natural environment. And I saw a lot of what had occurred kind of in the 70s and 80s in Ocean City, Maryland, and areas to the south, with just high-rise buildings right on the beach and creating these environments that were not very walkable, not very warm, I guess, or welcoming. Clearly, they, you know, in a lot of ways worked from a pro forma standpoint, I guess. But the question, you know, I've always had in my mind is like, what is this going to look like in 100 years? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you travel across other areas of the world, let's say even New York City, you know, there's a lot of things that have stood the test of time. And then there's a lot of things that kind of, you know, stand out as, you know, what were they thinking? Why did they do that? And so for me, I've always looked at any project that I've developed as something that's likely gonna, you know, outlive me for some significant amount of time. And so what is the legacy that I'm leaving, and how does a community that I've developed feel 50 years from now, 100 years from now? And I will admit, I don't think a lot of people think that way, unfortunately, but it also, I think, is why we have a lot of places that are not, you know, the most livable. So Anyway, that's been my area of focus, and I've been doing it now for almost 25 years, and I've built all over the U.S., primarily in the Mid-Atlantic and Texas, but some other places as well. And yeah, that's all we do is master plan community development.
Now, you mentioned something there, talking about the pro forma, basically how a project is pencils out, is what they say, works on paper to where that, you know, you can pay back your loans, everybody can make their profit and walk away from the project, not upside down. Can you talk a little bit about your mindset in approaching a project and the balance you have to find between the financial side and delivering something that makes people happy and comfortable in that community?
Well, it's a difficult equation to solve for, because especially when you start bringing in private equity, third-party capital, you know, there usually isn't alignment, I would say, in terms of, you know, the values that, you know, that I have. But and I will say, we made some wrong decisions in the beginning in terms of partners, and you know, we've had our share of issues, I guess, in projects where there wasn't alignment, and you know, I had a certain vision for the project, and that required, you know, spending a little bit more money on certain things than, you know, maybe was in their minds necessary. And in some cases, we had to part ways. In other cases, I had to compromise or sacrifice. And it's taken me a long time to get to a place where I've been able to find some like-minded capital partners that I work with. And I've also used less and less third-party capital. And I typically like to develop projects on my own in terms of any equity participation. For that reason, it's a real challenge. I mean, and it's not just coming from, you know, let's call it the private capital side of the equation. It's also coming from the municipal side or the, you know, the jurisdiction, the costs associated with permitting, inspections, and then, you know, all of the restrictions around building code. I mean, it's always crazy to me that a lot of the places that I go that are beautiful places have developed new land development regulations that would not allow them to build today what they built a couple hundred years ago that, you know, they want to preserve and they love. And so when I show up in those environments and I point that out, I guess the mindset is that, well, this was all done in the name of improvement. It's fire safety. It's 100-year floodplain. It's this, it's that. And what has essentially happened is that, in my opinion, quote unquote, experts have hijacked the system and each one has an opinion on what meets their unique needs. So the fire marshal says we've got to have these crazy turning radiuses and we've got to do all this stuff. And even in Delaware, you know, it'd be like, well, you know, we have to leave this much room for snow plows. I mean, it snows in Delaware like once a year, maybe, you know. So you design all these things around these crazy potential hypotheticals, and everyday living is diminished by some of these things. Now, I understand that there are certain things that are necessary and have benefited society in terms of, you know, fire separation and multifamily and sprinklering in certain cases and things like that. But there's also a lot of stuff, you know, that has just driven up the cost of development and construction. And most people don't understand that when they're buying a home today, that, you know, a $500,000 home could easily have $50,000 to $75,000 worth of just permitting and approval expenses that didn't exist 30, 40 years ago. So it's a challenge. I'll tell you one story. I developed a project in Milton, Delaware back in 2003, 4, 5, and 6. And I ended up, because I could, you know, I was having a hard time giving my vision for the project. I took the entire mayor and council of the town, put them on a bus, and drove them to a community over in Maryland that demonstrated some of the design principles. Project was called Lakelands and Kentlands, and showed them, hey, look, this is what, you know, new urbanism is. This is what these concepts are. This is what a 10-foot separation between buildings is. And allowing them to walk the community and see it convinced them to take a little bit of risk and bend some of the rules for me. So we've gone that far before.
Wow.
Every town's different. Every project's different. And I will say, because that project worked well, this newer project that we're doing in the same town was a bit easier of a sell. So,
to your point, there are a lot of people that are kind of stuck in the past of how, like you said, sort of protecting what they're in their mind is the way that a community should be. And you have to sort of educate. And, you know, we're all on this vein of trying to educate, you know, particular parties of how we can develop and build and design for the future. So it's fascinating to hear that you had to bus them to another location just to kind of show what you're planning.
Yeah. Yeah, I think oftentimes there's a disconnect between what people are told by, call it, engineers and experts needs to happen to protect the public and what actually feels good in terms of the built environment, you know, and it's very hard for people to understand. And there's always these competing interests. It's like, okay, well, we need 50-foot street widths for snow plowing, but we also want to make sure that people aren't driving 40 miles an hour down the street. And it's like, well, you know, sometimes those things are working against each other, oftentimes. And safety and fear, let's say, seems to always win the day. If an engineer can show up and instill enough fear in, you know, the public, then I'm probably going to lose. because I'm talking about what are somewhat in some people's minds, ethereal things like connectedness and combating isolation and the rates of depression and people feeling cut off from society and all these things. And they're talking about somebody getting buried in their house with snow and not being able to get out and dying, you know, and it's like, well, has that ever happened? I don't think so, but you know, that's, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of irrational arguments that get made. And I find there's a pattern that if it, fear is a strong motivator and it tends to win the game. So my job is to convince people that some of those fears are unfounded and that this is the greater good.
I would probably, at least from my perspective, I would reframe it a little bit in that I think it's a liability and risk thing that has taken over culture in general. And that's where a lot of this sort of stems from, is this possibility of being sued or being on the hook for something that just might happen to go wrong. And I think that has sort of created this groundswell of CYA on everybody from every direction. Yeah. And I think there is, to your point, there has to be some way that local jurisdictions take a little more responsibility in understanding what their immediate environment is like and what true risk is and is not, to be able to navigate this a little bit better and make communities happen.
Yeah. And I have an underlying premise that kind of drives everything. And that is that in terms of what's been done during my lifetime, let's say, I don't think it's working very well in most cases. I mean, the typical suburban environment of housing communities is not a great place to live. And it is one that makes people feel more separate. And human beings are not designed to live separately. We are designed to live in community. And I think it's being proven that that is not working, because the more and more that people feel cut off from community, which is happening not only because of the built environment, but also because of devices and technology and work at home and all of these other things that are continuing to, and, you know, then there's a whole set of political, I guess, ideology that is motivated to create separation. And you combine all of those things together, and generally people are feeling more isolated, more lonely, and more depressed. And so it's like, when are we going to push pause on this experiment that's not working out so well?
What do you see about, because I have this whole analysis about how the suburban design has turned inward rather than connecting. I talk about the porch going away, and rather than seeing your neighbors and hanging out on the porch with your neighbors, it was all about getting rid of sort of those kind of wasteful spaces and turning inward to create bonus rooms and larger rooms, and everyone has a suite and being insular only. Do you see something different about how housing evolved over time that kind of contributed to this loneliness? Does what I suggest make sense, or is it something different?
Yeah, I think that that is true, and that is a significant part of it. I also think that, you know, the materialist mindset is based on more square footage equals more happiness somehow. And that, you know, I'm not happy where I am right now because I just don't have enough room. I don't find that people's actual lived experience that turns out to be true. And, you know, the less time that people spend in their homes and the more time they spend out in their community, their immediate community especially, the more, you know, study after study has shown that, you know, generally people are more peaceful and happy. And connecting with the natural environment is a big part of that, but connecting with the natural environment with people is an even bigger part of that. And having social spaces, gathering spaces is a huge part of that. You know, you see this all the time. I was touring a house the other day and there was somebody had built a pretty elaborate patio off the master bedroom with gas fireplace and everything. And it was kind of off one wing of the house and then off the living room and kitchen, which is where most people end up spending their time. There was another patio and outdoor space with a fireplace and everything else. And it was a friend of mine who was interested in buying this house. He said, well, what do you think? I said, I think you should just rip this out and get rid of it completely. Like, you are absolutely never going to use this. When your kids and everybody are over here, everybody's in the kitchen, you're in the living room, you're doing all this. Like, when are you just going to sit out on this patio by yourself around a fireplace, you know, and what occasion would you use that space? But if you look at the builder model, let's say, that's a $30,000 option. If they can sell somebody on that, you know, it's like, you need to have this private space off the master and you should do. And so there's like a lot of, most people aren't necessarily directly connected with understanding space and, you know, where they're going to spend their time. But our goal in our communities is to get people out of their house, you know, in general. And the more we can get them to kind of move around the community, the more that their experience of our neighborhood is going to be one where they have this sense that they belong to something, that this place is more than a neighborhood. It represents a group of people that they have come to know and that they have an appreciation for living with. And what people would describe as, you know, quote unquote community, which is typically, you know, about 100 to 150 people that you can identify and you can say hi to on a regular basis because you know their name and you generally know a little bit about them. And that is very important, very important.
Yeah. Now, you talked a little bit about common spaces throughout the community for people to meet up. Are there any other design features with the home or the community that are tried and true things that have worked in achieving this goal of reconnecting people?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is preservation of natural space. There, usually in any community, there's certain distinct places that make sense to set aside because there's some natural feature there that is more interesting. And so getting that, you know, not only preserved, but also accessible is really important. I think bringing community into a new project is really important. So for example, in project we're developing right now, we're putting in two recreational sports fields, like turf fields, you know, that are really designed for the greater community to come and use. So there'll be events, recreational soccer, lacrosse, things like that. But the idea is to get the community, you know, to come into the neighborhood so that it's not just trying to create community amongst the people that are moving into the neighborhood.
Not just that individual bubble. You're talking about the surrounding areas as well.
Yeah. So integrating the greater community into the project is really important. And the best way to do that is to offer the greater community a reason, a benefit. And then we'll put in bouldering parks, skate parks, public basketball courts, things like that, that create, you know, natural, like kind of gathering places. And usually it's looking around at a place, like, you know, when we're planning a project and saying, okay, well, you know, for example, this 450-year-old town, it's beautiful, but what's missing? What don't they have? Okay, so what could we then provide that, you know, would compel somebody from this community to come into this new neighborhood and integrate it? Those are really powerful things. And then programming is very important as well. And giving people reasons to want to participate and giving them a little nudge to get out of the house and do things. And so programming, you know, events and, you know, social events and things like that around, you know, the neighborhood and doing that. And a lot of it is done not just for the neighborhood itself. Again, it's like, you know, we're throwing a party in one of our projects that's just launched here in another month, and we're doing it as a fundraiser for the fire department. And it's like, well, if we can do that, we can serve two needs, right? We can get the greater community to come out and see what's going on in this new project. And then, you know, the 25 residents that have moved in so far can feel like they're doing something, you know, for the greater community. And so there's all kinds of, and this is fairly common sense type stuff to me. You know, it's not, we're not really doing anything that's radically different or innovative. But back to your original question, it does require us to take a little risk with some capital and to spend a little bit more money on some things than maybe just makes sense in pure black and white, you know, dollars and cents. But we believe that ultimately, you know, there is a long-term payoff, and it depends on how you value ROI. And ROI to us is, you know, when we develop our next project and people point to this one that we did, what is our reputation? What is our history? Is that, you know, and that's important to us. And again, legacy is another one. What will generations, you know, of my family long after I'm gone think about the work that I did and what I cared about and what I valued? You know, it's not to say that making money and an ROI isn't important. It is. I mean, that's how we are able to function as a company, and I'm able to pay my people and do all of those things. But it's certainly equally important that we, the people that work for me, and that we are proud of what we do, you know. And that's another, you know, going back to kind of like some of the things that are not going so well right now, I think there's a lot of people that work in companies and they're not very proud of what they do. And, you know, that's unfortunate. It doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Any of the projects that you mentioned, are either of those the granary?
Yeah. The fundraiser for the fire department is in the granary. That's coming up.
So that one I found pretty interesting because it has some of those things that I was mentioning as well. I think most, if not all, of the plans that I looked at all have porches to some level. Mm-hmm. They're not overly large. You know, they're comfortable size homes. To your point about this isn't to barricade yourself in, get out, walk the neighborhood, engage with each other. Can you talk a little bit about your approach with this specific community and any other elements that made this one unique?
Sure. Each project I do, I get a little bit smarter. You know, there's always lessons learned and what could I have done better. And, you know, my concepts have evolved over time. And, you know, at one point I thought that new urbanism and, you know, a lot of the design of spaces, you know, that alone would do a lot in terms of creating community. And I think it does help significantly. But as we got into this latest iteration, the granary, you know, I started to connect the dots a little bit more around it not just being about kind of proximity between homes and setbacks and, you know, trying to keep, you know, zero lot line type things. And it was also about community gathering space and like trying to create what would feel like a natural, but was an intentional way of getting people to connect with each other. And so the porches, you know, all of those things, I think, you know, especially if people use them, and there's a science to that as well, which I'm, you know, happy to talk about, but they're visually inviting. First of all, you know, it's as you're going down the street, it's nostalgic in terms of the way that, you know, things, you know, were and how people used to live. And so, and it mimics, you know, the town that it's in, which, you know, has been around since the 1600s. Keeping the lots small, I think, is also really important. And it's not important because we can jam more homes in. It's important because if I can allocate that space to things that are shared, then there's, you know, much more of a reason for people to get outside their home and go visit those places. So, you know, you may not be able to toss a Frisbee in your backyard, but there's plenty of places to do that in the community. And when you do that and you're out there playing, let's say, that invites other people to join and to want to do things as well. And that tends to be why people gravitate towards more urban environments, typically, especially younger people, because, you know, they have a greater sense of connection to others because of a lot of what they need, you know, to do to kind of enjoy the area is outside of the home, you know, going to restaurants, going to the gym. You know, if every home, you know, is 3 acres, they have a gym in the home, they have their own home theater, you know, they pull into their garage, park, go into their house that's, you know, air conditioned, get up in the morning, get into their car, pull out of the garage, go to their office and never connect with anyone in their neighborhood. I mean, it's amazing how many people, they'll live in a neighborhood for 10 years and they might know the neighbor to the right and the left, but nobody else in the entire, and it's just, to me, that's just mind-boggling, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, the whole idea of like community support and older generations aging and, you know, feeling unsupported. I mean, that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, we've kind of kicked the aging population into assisted living facilities and asked them to kind of, you know, finish out the later years of their life in isolation there. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of crazy. You know, you go to a place like Vietnam and, you know, you see these compounds where there's like 4 houses and like a garden in the middle. And it's kind of one house is for grandparents, the older generation. And then you've got 2 or 3 different kids with families that are living in the same place. And they're all kind of aging in place and they're taking care of each other. And it's not surprising that they're substantially happier than most people, you know, living in suburban America. So I don't, you know, specifically, we're putting a brewery incubator in the granary. That's one that I'm having fun with that I've never done before.
That's cool.
And so the whole idea there is, you know, I love, you know, entrepreneurship and startups. And so the idea is to basically build a building and put 2 full breweries in it and then lease the space at a pretty affordable price to anybody who wants to get into that business, allow them to not have the capital cost of millions of dollars of stainless steel and startup expenses, get a leg up, but then provide a service, which is a, you know, a tasting room where people from the community can come and try the product and interact with others. And it's, and then as they are more successful, they can then go move on and graduate to something bigger and somebody else can come in. So we're going to test that out. And if that works fairly well, we might do some other things with other types of businesses related to health and wellness. And we are going to experiment with some new product that's more of a communal living type product for both older and younger people, where there would be multiple dwellings in, you know, in one small kind of lot with like a common kitchen and living room that can be shared. And it would allow us to bring the price point down for kind of more of a first time home buyer, maybe without kids, that wants to own a product, but then, you know, is comfortable, you know, sharing some space with other people when they want to. In phase 5 of the project, we've been starting to just brainstorm some of those ideas. And so we always are testing some things and trying new things, and we'll see what else develops. We're constantly thinking about it.
Yeah, that's exciting stuff. Before we leave it, I wanted to see if you can kind of explain a little bit of that science of how you activate a porch.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the internal design of the home, you know, is, and I, you're the architect, not me, but this, you know, I'll, I'll give you my thoughts on it from what I've seen, I guess, because I've had, you know, the first home that I ever lived in was, it was built in the 1700s. And I found that I was living out of the back of the house most of the time. And that's because the kitchen lived out of the back of the house and the barbecue was out of the back of the house. And how the interior of the home is set up is really important in terms of whether people will actually use that area in the front and live out of the front of the home. And so it's got to be convenient and it's got to be easy. And so pushing a lot of the more functional uses like the kitchens and things like that up to where, you know, the front porch becomes a place where, you know, that's meaningful, where you can gather. Like an outdoor dining space, you know, a screen porch with an outdoor dining space, something like that. We've seen that that works a lot better. Also limiting the amount of replica space, you know, so it's like if you have the front porch, but you also have a huge screened in porch off the back, which one are people likely to use? You know, they're probably going to use the one, you know, in the back of the house. So pushing people to live out the front of the home, it really does come down to, and we only have so much control over that. We are going to build a couple hundred of the homes in the community ourselves for that reason. So they'll be kind of more custom product. We have regional and national builders in the project as well. And, you know, while we are very particular about some of the, you know, general exterior designs and materials they use and things like that, I mean, when it gets down to floor plans, you know, we only have so much control. So, but we can force a lot of things by limiting lot size and creating these robust amenities and gathering spaces to get people out. And so that's, you know, we put a lot of our focus into that as well.
Hey, I don't know everything, so I'm glad to throw it to you to educate me on what you've seen and experienced too. Now, I wanted to touch back on that element about the custom home, because I saw that was pretty interesting, at least the way it's framed. Are the other homes that are not the quote custom homes, are those pretty much like fixed products that you cannot alter at all? And then the custom that you're doing, like what's the level of customization you can do with those? And how does that differ between other product?
Yeah, so DRB and DR Horton are right now in phases 1 through 4. They're building about 600 of those homes, and we are building about 100. And when I say we, I mean that will be the custom product. The custom product is highly flexible in terms of, you know, what can be done. And we're looking at a couple of different ways of doing it. Some will be pre-designing, you know, some custom product and building that for people, like highly varied, each home being completely different.
With like a lot of options.
A lot of options, yeah. And a lot of options for a buyer to come in and, you know, say, control, you know, depending on where we are in the process of construction, control what and change what happens there. We may sell some lots just as custom lots available for people to build, you know, their own product that they're designing. There will be some scrutiny over the design standards, but in terms of highly customized ability to modify as they see fit, you know, that those options are going to be available. And then with the DR Horton and DRB products, they have been as flexible as I have ever seen production builders be in terms of changing their product to meet our needs. So they've really worked with us on this. You know, we had about a 6-month process of redesigning a lot of their product to fit with kind of more of a contemporary farmhouse look that we wanted in the community, which was not product that they necessarily had, but were willing to create for us. And so that was great. And then who knows what happened? We have another 700 lots after that. And complete freedom and flexibility to do whatever we want with them. It could be more with DRB and DR Horton, or we, you know, we could go a different direction and have it much more customizable. We don't exactly know yet.
Well, this is an exciting project. I really love the brewery incubator idea and even future business options for that concept. I really like that. One last question for you as far as developing your communities was, do you typically on past ones and this one tend to just sort of hand it off to a separate management company, or do you guys continue management of these communities?
We manage everything ourselves, and which is why we can only do a couple of projects at a time, because, you know, there's so much that goes into it. It's such an intense process of, I mean, last week we were looking at, you know, the flower beds in one of the entranceways, and, you know, we're doing a lot of natural wildflower plantings and things around the community. And, you know, those can take a couple of years to really populate and flourish. And so we were like, well, okay, maybe temporarily we need to put in some flower arrangements. So there's just like, that's just one example. I mean, it's like every day it's so intense in terms of just trying to manage something at this scale. So we're, you know, I'm a control freak. so, you know, I either need to be all the way in or all the way out. There's no in between. So, and we're experimenting. There's another idea that we're talking about right now, which is kind of like a spiritual gathering place in the community. I've been batting it around with my VP of development the last couple of weeks, you know, which would be kind of like a more of a regional like meditation center. And so I've been kind of working on that and, you know, what does it look like? We're putting in phase two, we're putting a meditation garden, which is going to be kind of interesting. It's going to have all kinds of cool artwork and a labyrinth and some different things like that. But I think I want to create more of a like a central kind of spiritual center, meditation center, something where, you know, it would be open to the community for different programming. Various religions can use it for different things. You know, it'd be a central space where people could use for all kinds of, you know, and it's generally the idea that we focus a lot on the natural environment. We focus a lot on community, but connection to spirit is a big part of it as well, in terms of human happiness. And so we're really digging into that one now as well. So you can get a beer or you can meditate all within a few minutes walk. Yeah.
I love that. Perfect way to leave this. Colby, I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm definitely going to be following along with you guys going forward. What's the best way for listeners to follow along if they want to learn more and see what you're up to?
Sure. Well, the website for that project is thegranarymilton.com. My website for Convergence Communities is just convergencecommunities.com. I do have a Instagram handle, but I think if you just search, I can't remember what it is, but I'm posting on there every now and then. But those are probably the best ways. And then hopefully we'll be, you know, following up over the years and in terms of the progress, because I'm sure things will change. Hopefully, you know, we'll continue to come up with new ideas and add new things. And yeah, love to talk to you again about it.
Yeah. Definitely. Let's get it on the calendar. I'd be happy to check in with you and see how things are going.
Cool. Well, I love what you're doing here.
Thank you. Colby, really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you to the listeners for listening, and we will talk again on the next one. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.